This is the Up North Lowdown, and it has been a week. I'm Ed Ronco. Before we get to the two big pieces of news this week, I should tell you that a little later in this episode, we'll have some wonderful stories for you. One of them is about citizen science and a frog and toad survey.
It was magical. It was just a magical thing to do, and you feel like you're doing something good.
And the other is about the Michigan Supreme Court taking a trip up north. But the last 7 or 8 days have included some surprises for us, and so that is where we are beginning this episode.
This is not like bad news that we're releasing today.
That's the voice of filmmaker Michael Moore on the phone with IPR. He's the founder and president of the Traverse City Film Festival. And the news that he's talking about caught a lot of people here by surprise. Here it is. This summer, there will not be a Traverse City Film Festival. The organization canceled its annual event for good, saying it is time to close this era. The festival had just climbed out of debt. Moore says they spend about $2 million on the week-long festival each year, and that this decision is, at least in part, to avoid going back into the red. But he also told us he's excited about the future, that there are some big plans in the works.
We're in the process, the board and I, of making some decisions to take the Traverse City Film Festival in a different direction. I think when people hear what we end up doing in the coming year or two with the Traverse City Film Festival, they're going to go, oh my God, this is a much better idea.
Still, it is tough news for Traverse City, especially downtown businesses that count on festival goers to spend lots of money at restaurants and hotels and stores. Here's Trevor Tkach, who runs Traverse City Tourism.
You're talking about midweek business, and that was kind of the beauty of this particular event. It was celebrated midweek, and that kind of helps with the trough, if you will, in between weekends to maintain demand. That helps businesses stay more fully active and helps employees, you know, take full advantage of those opportunities in the summer months to potentially make more revenue.
The festival plans to continue operating its two theaters, the State and the Bijou by the Bay, year-round, just like before. Just no red carpet or big crowds this summer. Our other big story is one we've mentioned here before, Camp Grayling. This is, to remind you, a huge training facility run by the Michigan National Guard, right in the middle of the Mitten. The Guard wants to more than double its size. And we've been covering the story for months, and we have been waiting, also for months, to find out whether the State Department of Natural Resources would let the Guard expand Camp Grayling. And the answer turned out to be no, sort of. The state denied the lease request for the Guard, all that land that they wanted, but they're going to let them apply for special use permits on less land than they originally sought. People who have been vocally opposed to the expansion were not pleased by this decision. Reporter Michael Livingston explained why on our local broadcast of Morning Edition, talking to IPR's Tyler Thompson.
Much of the opposition rallies behind this phrase, not one more acre, meaning they believe the Guard should not acquire any land for any length of time. Camp Grayling is already the largest National Guard training facility in the country. And I brought that point up to DNR spokesman Ed Golder, and here's what he told me.
Say that that not one more acre was leased in this process. So in terms of that concern, that has certainly been addressed. And in terms of public access, that's addressed in the memorandum of understanding we have with the Guard, that public access would continue uninterrupted in all areas where the Guard is training or where they're not, regardless of whether the Guard is on the landscape. So I think we listen to those concerns and we address them very directly in this process.
Another important point here is that the DMVA will have to pay fees and costs associated with applying for permits, just like everyone else.
Roger. So where do we go from here?
Well, the Guard said in a press release it's content with the DNR's decision, even though it doesn't meet the, quote, full vision. Opposition is going to continue fighting this. On social media, if you check this out and just search Camp Grayling, you're going to see some people celebrating, but underneath those posts, you'll see a lot more people saying, this is just a half win. There's still more work we have to do. The questions on my mind that I want answers to in the days and weeks to come are, you know, what are these special use permits going to look like? Has the Guard already put one through the system? Is it already waiting on approval? How long will they get to access that 52,000 acres if they access that much? And how do they plan to gain back this trust that they've lost with residents in the past decade?
That's IPR's Michael Livingston speaking with Tyler Thompson earlier this week. Every spring since 1996, volunteers from around the state have participated in a frog and toad survey. Their data goes to the Department of Natural Resources, and it helps paint a picture of how amphibians are doing and how the environment is changing. But this spring, after 27 years of citizen science, Michigan's frog and toad survey has been canceled indefinitely. IPR's Patrick Shea tells us more.
It's a late April afternoon on the old Mission Peninsula, and Kathy Gray, a 10-year volunteer, takes me to her favorite spot on her survey route.
We're at Brinkman Road Vernal Pond.
She takes out a thick binder covered in amphibian stickers and a picture of a road sign reading, "Frog parking only. All others will be towed."
That was from a friend. Yeah. People would send me stuff because they knew that I was into it.
Inside the binder are stacks of paper, data sheets, used for the same purpose since the mid-1990s. Volunteers would write down their location, the date and time, the temperature, and the level of frog call intensity.
And we were estimating their numbers with this rank by saying that there was four different choices. You could be a zero, meaning, like now, we don't hear any frogs. Or a one, where we could identify three or four different individuals. But as soon as it becomes more than like four or five, then you could say, no, that's a two instead of a one. And then when you have a full chorus of frogs or toads, then that's a three.
Participating in this survey has been a yearly highlight for Kathy over the past decade. She says she loves the familiarity of visiting the same spots year after year, and listening closely to the soundscape of a spring or summer night.
I was there the other night listening, and I could hear three varieties of frogs and toads trilling. And sorry, I got a frog in my throat. And the owls were hooting, and the moon was almost full. It was magical. It was just a magical thing to do. And you feel like you're doing something good. You know, you're making a difference.
Making a difference by helping wildlife officials monitor the health of frogs and toads in Michigan, and in turn, the health of their ecosystem. So when Kathy heard that the survey wasn't happening this year, she took it hard.
I was outraged. I was just so shocked and flabbergasted, and I couldn't believe that they would abandon their data. So I fired off some angry emails to people, and surprisingly, they got back to me.
The DNR's rationale has to do with staffing. Tony Heenahan is with the Michigan DNR.
For any kind of public-facing project, especially one as large as the Frog and Toad Survey was, we require quite a bit of energy and time and resources into coordinating volunteers. So that includes getting data sheets out to folks, as well as reaching out to new volunteers, training those volunteers, getting them up to speed, answering questions, tracking all of that. In addition to that, that person would also need to manage all the data sheets as they come in at the end of the season.
That means doing a quality check on the hundreds of survey packets that come in and making sure they're entered correctly into the DNR's database. Then the DNR would also need to coordinate requests for that data that come in from outside researchers. Heenahan says that's just some of the work that goes into the tail end of an annual survey.
That is a lot of time for someone to do, and so someone, whoever would take that on, needs to have a lot of time built into the position that does that. We currently just don't have that capacity.
So then how did the DNR manage all of that in the past? Well, from the mid-90s through 2015, they had help from the federal government. Back then, the U.S. Geological Survey ran a service called the North American Amphibian Monitoring Program. That set the framework for many states that launched amphibian surveys in the 90s. And USGS employees helped process the data. But that program ended in 2015, leaving states on their own. Michigan ran its own survey for 6 years until it deemed the effort to be too heavy a lift. A similar scenario played out a few states over, in Minnesota. Its survey was canceled in 2017, but this year it's coming back. Mags Edwards is the non-game wildlife community science coordinator for the Minnesota DNR. They're overseeing a relaunch of the Frog and Toad survey, with some big changes.
The data previously was collected on paper data sheets, and some people are still doing that. but we've developed a mobile application using a platform called Survey123 that volunteers can just record their data in the field right then.
So in Michigan's, there's like a 1, 2, or 3 on like loudness of the calls. Is that what you mean by recording the data, or through this app, are they literally hitting record and getting the sounds?
Both. So when I say they're recording data, I mean that for each species that they hear, they're entering that 1, 2, or 3 that you refer to, which we call calling intensity. But there also is the option in the app to just hit record and for them to record what they're hearing, which is pretty neat, because in the past, if people thought they were hearing something unexpected, they would, I mean, they could try to use a tape recorder or try to get a photo, but trying to get a photo of a frog at night is pretty much impossible.
Edward says they can see the volunteers' data being uploaded in real time, and that's a time saver. The Minnesota DNR no longer has to wait till the end of the survey to tally it all up.
So I've got a map on my screen right now, and I can click on people's survey routes and see what they have been hearing. It is an amazing way to help schedule the survey.
Edwards says the public response to this relaunch has been very positive.
One of the first volunteers that I spoke to, she was just so glad that the survey was coming back, and she talked about how at the end of her survey run, she always just shuts off the car and just sits there and listens, and that she can just, you know, almost feel these frogs and toads calling around her when it's a full chorus like that. And I just know that it is very important for people to be connected to their natural world, because we take care of what we care about. And I think that having an opportunity for people to feel connected to the world that we live in and the world that we depend on is valuable in and of itself.
Minnesota's relaunch could foreshadow what's to come in Michigan. Tony Heenahan with the Michigan DNR says a relaunch is the ultimate goal.
The volunteers who have been doing this are very passionate about this survey. We don't want to stop that for them, and we don't want to break those relationships. We simply want to retool it and revamp it so that way it can keep going for another 20 years and be a good survey for us.
I hope it comes back. I hope I'm still around when they bring it back.
Again, Kathy Gray on the Old Mission Peninsula.
I hope, you know, I said to them in my emails, and I was angry at the time, and I'm glad that they responded so graciously. And I thanked them when I wrote back, and I said, please, you know, count us in. We want to continue to do this. You know, it's date night.
Gray says she'll still go out to hear the frogs and toads this season, but she looks forward to doing her part for their conservation again.
Reporter Patrick Shea. The Up North Lowdown. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Max Copeland, the producer of Up North Lowdown. And I just want to know, how do you stay up to date with the latest news? Well, the Up North Lowdown is a great way to do that, but maybe you're looking for more. IPR Daily Headlines is a daily news podcast from Interlochen Public Radio, and it makes a great addition to the Up North Lowdown. New episodes drop every weekday at noon, so you can stay up to date with all the news from around Michigan. Listen to IPR Daily Headlines wherever you're listening to this podcast, or find out more at our website, iprnews.org. All right, on with the show.
Welcome back to The Lowdown. I'm Ed Ronco. One more story for you this week. The Michigan Supreme Court made a visit up north not too long ago to hear a case in Sheboygan. This case didn't really have anything to do with Sheboygan, but from time to time, the court likes to take its show on the road in front of an audience of high school students. Again, IPR's Michael Livingston.
The historic Sheboygan Opera House is at full capacity as high school students from around the region arrive in buses. Police officers are checking bags at the entrance, and ushers are showing people to their seats. Today's event will be a first for this nearly 150-year-old opera house. After some introductions, the theater falls silent, and the Michigan Supreme Court justices appear from behind the curtain.
The court is now sitting. God save the United States, the state of Michigan, and this honorable court.
This is the 27th time that the Supreme Court has traveled to hear a case somewhere other than Lansing. It's part of the Court Community Connections Program, which launched in 2007 and normally holds 2 remote hearings a year. The goal? Have students leave today with a better understanding of how the judicial system works.
I now call our case for the morning, People versus Candace Guyton, docket number 163700.
That was Chief Justice Elizabeth Clement. The case justices are looking at today stems back to a 2019 armed robbery involving Candace Guyton and her accomplice. In a nutshell, Guyton's defense says she was misinformed about her plea agreement when she agreed to be charged as a third offense habitual offender.
When we're talking about a person's liberty, getting anything less than what she bargained for was not knowing, was not understanding, was not accurate, and was a violation of her due process rights.
But the Kent County prosecutor argues she knew the terms before withdrawing her guilty plea later on.
She knew when she pled guilty that she would not be charged with any sentence enhancement. She knew that she would not be facing a second armed robbery, and she knew the guidelines range for her sentence.
After hearing these arguments, the justices retreated behind the curtains to talk about how this case should proceed. None of those decisions would be made public on this day. But meanwhile, students got the chance to ask attorneys questions about their arguments. Understandably, the legal jargon was the most confusing part for a lot of students.
I'm sorry, but I had no idea what you guys were talking about the whole time.
But the tiny details of this case aren't why the students are here. It was to see how a case can move through the system and eventually find its way to the highest court in the state. Spanish exchange student Claudia Blanco of Traverse City Central High School said she's going to tell people back home about all the formalities in American courts.
I feel like I would tell them how respectful is people here to their country and how respectful are like teenagers to people that have authority.
Other students said they admired the lawyer's ability to speak in front of over 300 people while being questioned by some scary-looking justices.
It was inspirational, kind of, because I want to be a lawyer when I grow up, so it was cool to see that kind of stuff firsthand.
Kara's civics teacher, Caitlin Tippett, said she thinks it's important for her students to know what they may be facing as they get older. After all, civic engagement isn't something that happens inside a classroom.
I think it's important that they know that this is going to impact their lives, and it could absolutely be something that they find, a situation they find themselves in the future.
After the Q&A with attorneys, students got the chance to meet and talk with the justices backstage. They asked about what a typical day is like for a judge and how many years of law school it took to get to their positions. Opera House Executive Director Owen Goslin says he feels assured many students left today feeling inspired by the court, an opportunity they might not have had without the Community Connections program.
As somebody who grew up in Sheboygan, we think of Lansing as like distant place. You know, some of these kids may not have left Northern Michigan or even Sheboygan County. So for the court to recognize them and to see our community is huge.
That's reporter Michael Livingston in Sheboygan. Let's find out what else is news. The Michigan Senate approved a bill to add reproductive rights to the state's civil rights law. It is in line with a state constitutional amendment approved by voters last fall. Under this bill, you can't fire someone or deny them a promotion because they've had an abortion. And employer health plans that cover pregnancy care would also be barred from refusing to cover abortion services. The bill now goes to the governor for her signature. In some northern Michigan school districts, students can be on a school bus for about an hour each way. Educators here are asking for more money from the state for student transportation. School funding is given out on a per-student basis, but school districts in rural areas often have fewer students and way more ground to cover. Michigan's Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy, EAGLE for short, will start using a new kind of test for PFAS chemicals. Those are toxins, industrial toxins, that can be present in drinking water, caused by things like firefighting foam on military bases and airports. Officials said the new method won't be noticeable to the general public, but will provide more comprehensive results for regulators. And that's it for this week's Lowdown. Thanks for listening. I'm Ed Ronco. Our producer is Max Copeland, and we make this podcast at Interlochen Public Radio. We had help this week from Michael Livingston, Tyler Thompson, Patrick Shea, and Jeffrey Reddick. Music is by Blue Dot Sessions. Before we go, we should tell you that Michigan added 58 new species to its list of animals and plants that are threatened or endangered. It also took another 36 species off the list. Three different kinds of bats are in trouble, along with bumblebees. Trumpeter swans, on the other hand, are doing just fine. So, they get the final word this week.